And welcome to another exciting episode of Hollywood Blockbusters. I am your host, Joe Hollywood. And once again, I am joined by Imaginos Pete.
Hey, hey.
And also Finding Andrew Walker.
Yes.
Oh, well
Finding
done.
Finding Andrew Walker. Andrew Lightyear.
That should be the third part of a trilogy that needs to be completed because Pixar did two Finding movies. We need a third one.
Finding Andrew.
Being Johnny on the spot.
He's lost somewhere down in Hamtramck.
You know, I'd like to point something out. Andrew cleaned himself up. I thought I was being professional, getting a little beard trim here because I was starting to look a little bit like Kaczynski, but look at Andrew. Andrew went the full nine on it.
I know. Whenever I let my beard grow out, I think I look like, you know, a Chippendale dancer or something, and then I realize I look like, like you said, the Unabomber.
I was in trouble when the Detroit Zoo was doing double takes and looking at me. I'm like, no, fellas, I'm not missing from the enclosure. Just, I better go get a trim.
Why are those guys following me with a net?
Yeah.
All right. So today's theme is Disney and Pixar. They have a release schedule for 2024 that's pretty interesting. And most of them are either prequels or sequels. But apparently Disney has gotten in the habit of re-releasing some of their previous movies back into theaters. And I don't know if that helps pad their grosses or what they're trying to do. But this past weekend, just before this podcast, they re-released Luca, which was originally released in 2021. Have either one of you seen Luca?
No, I have not got a chance.
It was not on my radar, and I found out that it, despite the fact that it was released back in theaters, it's still on Disney Plus. So I sat down to watch it just to get familiar with it, and probably about 15 minutes into it, I turned it off. And Luca is just another Pixar movie in a string of Pixar movies that have been released over the past couple of years that I just don't get. I don't understand. I don't like them. And I'm not sure what's happening with Pixar. There's a few movies that I was excited about and went to go see in theaters and almost walked out. One example is, what's the one? Well, Inside Out, that's the one about like emotions and stuff, right?
Yeah.
And they have a sequel to that coming out on June 14th, Inside Out 2, where Riley continues to navigate her confusing new emotions as she enters her teenage years. And there's been some interesting discussions about that particular movie. Some conservatives, I guess you might say, after seeing a sneak preview of that particular movie, think that Riley might be a lesbian. And they're up in arms about that. And I'm like, You're coming away with it from the trailer? Okay.
Wow.
But I saw the first Inside Out, and even though overall I liked it, I thought it was one of the most depressing movies that Pixar had ever put out. And Riley doesn't get redeemed, I guess, for lack of a better word, until like the last 5 minutes of the movie. And most movies kind of have this structure. There's first act, second act, third act. The second act is always the dark act where there's conflict and bickering and arguing.
Sure.
And I remember as I watched Inside Out, that second act came and I'm like, oh, here's the dark middle act. And it kept going and going and going. And I'm like, this movie's going to end soon. When are they going to resolve this? And it was within the last few minutes of the movie that it finally get resolved. And I'm like, that was a long middle act. So even though overall I enjoyed it, that was yet another movie in a string of Pixar movies that I just didn't really feel like it was for me. What was the other movie? Soul. Did you see Soul?
Yeah. Yes, I am.
Andrew, you see Soul?
Nope.
That's another one where I enjoyed certain aspects of it, but some of it was just way out there, like really artsy. And when they were dealing with a person's soul, I guess, and a person's spirit, they did some really wild, wacky things. And I preferred the parts of the movie that were grounded in reality, that were on planet Earth. And then when they started getting into the artsy soul realm, I'm like, I don't know what's going on here. And so I feel like over the past few years, Pixar has really gotten experimental and kind of out there, and I don't necessarily feel like those movies speak to me. Other movies that are coming out this year, Moana 2. Yeah. Not necessarily the live action version. I guess that's in pre-production with The Rock playing, what's his name? Returns as Maui.
Yeah.
So he's going to play Maui in a live action version of Moana, but on November 27th, they're going to do an animated sequel, Moana 2, where Moana continues her spiritual journey of self-discovery as she braves the high seas and takes on dangerous missions in Oceania. Dwayne will be back to the voice that, and Alan Tudyk is going to introduce a new character, Hi-Hi or Hey-Hey or something like that. What were your thoughts of Moana when you saw Moana?
I enjoyed it. I didn't really have the same reaction as I did with the early Toy Stories. I mean, Toy Story, the earlier Pixar movies. I will say this, regarding the Inside Out that you mentioned, my perspective is that Riley was not the main character. It was actually Happy, Joy, and Sorrow.
Yeah.
And their story. And then it's reflected their bond and their understanding that they need each other to form. Like, their memories have to kind of commingle for Riley to be at peace.
Yeah.
I think that's why maybe it took that turn, because the main characters are those two rather than Riley. It's just their actions are reflected in Riley and how she turns out. That's why it felt like, I kind of agreed. I was like, well, Riley finally came together in the last 5 minutes, but that's because it took Joy and Sorrow to go up there. Regarding Moana, that was one of those instances where I feel like when Pixar goes all human, they tend to struggle. If they don't have an object or a thing that they can kind of humanize through. Like Wall-E. Wall-E was about the robots helping the humans. The humans were just kind of like the side characters. It was all about the robot. Bug's Life perspective through a bug.
Yeah.
Finding Nemo. Cars, which I'd never really particularly care for, but Cars. Then you had Toy Story, which is the most, until you got to The Incredibles, which was the first human
family. Yeah, and that's
the
exception to the rule that you just said, yeah.
But when they try to go with, you know, with Soul, Coco even, you know, trying to follow, you know, it gets into this war area. I enjoyed Brave. I actually like Brave.
I liked Brave up to a certain point. And when her mother gets turned into a bear, spoiler alert, I was done. I was like, what the hell is going on here? That aspect of the story completely turned me off.
That reminds me, when they do all human stories, there's the thing where they change a human into some other, either an animal or an object to get that, see if there's some kind of vibe going on there.
Yeah.
I feel like that's what they do when they start off with an all human cast.
Yeah.
And so,
now for me, predating Pixar, when Disney was releasing those classic animated movies in theaters, it was kind of the opposite of what you're talking about now. I preferred the movies that had the human characters, starting with Little Mermaid, even though she was half human, you know, followed by Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin. Those are some of my favorite Disney movies of all time, and those were all, for the most part, human-based. Now, I am in the minority here. No. I'm saying this predates Pixar. I'm in the minority here that when Disney went all animal in The Lion King, I didn't like The Lion King. And I know that shocks the heck out of people, because when you ask most people, what are your favorite Disney movies? Lion King is like number one for a lot of people. Lion King did not do it for me.
Please direct all angry mail to Joe the Blasphemer at gmail.com.
And I just watched it again recently. I bought it on DVD. I wanted it to be part of my DVD collection because I think DVDs are disappearing. But I did buy Lion King and just recently watched it, and I enjoyed it. I can't say that I hate the movie or anything like that. It just doesn't rank highly on my list of Disney movies. And again, I might be in the minority here. I probably am in the minority here. I thought that some of the songs in Lion King were some of the worst Disney songs. The song "I Can't Wait to Be King" just sounded like bad pop.
Yep.
Like not that. What are the composers' names?
Alan Menken.
Menken, and there's another one. The Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid and Aladdin. Those songs were like Broadway show tunes. They were rich and just, you know, you could sing them. You watch the movie once and you're singing those movies or those songs after the movie, you know. And Lion King, I didn't care necessarily for the music. I thought it was too poppy and not Broadway enough.
Would Lion King make your Mount Rushmore?
Not in any category. No, none. No.
I'm talking about just Disney animation.
Yeah, no. Lion King is like near the bottom for me. And I know people are going to say, you're out your goddamn mind. But no, Lion King didn't do it for me.
For me, it's Little Mermaid. That just wouldn't make my, anything for you. Wouldn't make my rush. Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast would.
Yeah, yeah.
For two, but I don't know if Little Mermaid makes my Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, when Little Mermaid came out, it wasn't on my radar. I kind of dismissed it as just a movie for kids or whatever. And then I started, you know, hearing all the feedback from people who were like, oh my God, it's amazing. And when I finally did get around to seeing the original animated Little Mermaid, I was blown away. I'm like, this is incredible. But the one thing that shocked me was the violence and the darkness. Like, imagine having a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old and you're thinking, oh, I could show them Little Mermaid. There's some messed up stuff in Little Mermaid. I guess all Disney movies have some messed up aspect of it.
Well, not as bad as showing them the Black Cauldron. That'll put you on someone's dirty list for a while.
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. Little Mermaid, I enjoy it now. It wasn't necessarily geared toward me, but the music was amazing. But, yeah, surprisingly dark twist in a lot of those movies. I mean, you could look at Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, and I remember seeing The Hunchback of Notre Dame and going, okay, this is really weird. When they had that religious figure, like, smelling her hair and stuff, I'm like, what is going on? So, yeah, Disney movies get a little dark.
I had a friend kind of make a comment. He goes, oh, I see. That guy does it, and it's creepy. Joe Biden does it, and it's fine, huh? Okay. I'm like, all right, come on, man. That's not cool. Can't we just talk about Pocahontas or something?
Yeah, so getting back to Moana, I only watched Moana fairly recently, within probably the last 6 months or so. Yeah. It was okay. Again, it just took some weird turns in the story. But here's a gripe that I have. I don't know if you guys agree with this or not. I, for one, really respect voiceover actors that, you know, a single person can play a multiple of different characters. There's a guy, I wish I could pull his name up, but he voices all the clones in the Bad Batch animated series, and every clone sounds distinct and different, but it's one guy doing all the voices. So I really admire voiceover actors. When you cast The Rock in Moana, all I hear is The Rock.
Yep.
And even when he's singing, it's The Rock trying to sing.
Yeah.
I don't like the trend of stunt casting voiceover roles with known actors, and I can't separate myself from that. I hear The Rock in Moana.
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say I completely agree with that, because for two things. The first one is what you said, Joe, is he's a extremely popular actor, not just in America, but the world around. So when people see that, the animation, and hear it, they're going to be like, oh, okay, I know who that is.
Yeah.
Now, from Disney's point of view, it makes sense because, yeah, they're going to spend a little more money, but that's a draw.
Yeah, it's a Dwayne Johnson film now.
The downside to that is you're putting somebody out of work who has spent probably 15 to 30 years developing their voice, and you're taking that job from them. Somebody who's probably not worth $100 million like The Rock is.
Yeah. And you need more money, Dwayne.
Right. But you're taking that job from that person who probably really needs it.
Yeah.
I think.
That doesn't sit right with me.
But it goes to both you both. Could you think of who's the actor that played Princess Jasmine or Aladdin or Belle or Beauty? They're all
It's hard
stage
to
actors.
Name them. Yeah.
But they're all great performances. They're all. I felt they've all been trying to capture the Robin Williams magic from when they brought Robin.
Yeah,
like, that's Robin Williams.
Yeah,
that I think that was a turning point.
They were like, oh my god! But you need that's the exception, not the rule.
Yeah, and that's Robin Williams. Like, they just hit record and said, "All right, do your thing, Robin. We'll get back to you when
we'll
you're
animate
done.
Around you."
Like, that's Robin Williams.
Yeah, and it's like you don't have to follow the script. Just start talking, improvising. We got a camera on you.
Yeah, and so even though, you know, I guess I'm kind of being a hypocrite here, because when I do watch Aladdin, I hear Robin Williams. That's Robin Williams. But he was so brilliant in that role, and Will Smith just couldn't hold a candle to him in the live action.
But it's
remake.
Little things like that. I mean, I think it's the comedians. Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
You can hear Billy Crystal both in Monsters, Inc., and I think it was he Pumbaa?
No, I think he was only Monsters, Inc. Nathan Lane was the meerkat.
Yeah, meerkat.
And I forget the actor's name who was the warthog, but... But yeah, Billy Crystal just did Monsters Inc. And yeah, it's him and John Goodman. They're clearly Billy Crystal and John Goodman. So yeah, even though they were great in those roles, I'm just not a fan of the stunt casting. And you know, it's kind of funny. Pixar sort of painted themselves into a corner because imagine the first time that John Ratzenberger voiced a character in a Pixar movie. I think it was Ham in Toy Story. And somehow they decided that they were going to bring him back for every Pixar movie. He's been, I think, in every Pixar movie, at least a cameo. The problem with John Ratzenberger is when you hear his voice, you go, "Oh, there it is. There's John Ratzenberger. There's his cameo." And you're no longer invested in the fantasy of this film. Now you're seeing John Ratzenberger behind a microphone voicing this character.
But does it also come down to performances? Like, when I can hear Tim Allen in Buzz, but I like how Tim Allen described him. I was playing a guy as if he had a closed head injury. That's how he described Buzz Lightyear. I played him and then Tom Hanks was basically, you could hear Tom Hanks, but yeah. It's the emotion. I think they did a test. If you ever get a chance, anybody out there to get up, watch a Pixar Story. It's a documentary done about it.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely fabulous documentary. I'd recommend. I think it's on Disney Plus if it's still there. And you see the type of creativity and kind of like the frenetic pace they went to making that. And when they recruited Tom Hanks, it was amazing. They did a little test run. They took a Turner and Hooch scene there. "Not the car. Oh, you hate the car, you stupid dog." And they animated Woody doing that. And he said, "This was unbelievable. I didn't know how to describe it to friends, but I was sold."
Yeah, it is amazing how Tom Hanks and what's his name?
Tim Allen.
But Tim Allen. How they are just linked to those characters. Like, I can't imagine another actor stepping in to try and fill those roles. They couldn't do it. Now, one interesting thing is I was watching an interview with Tom Hanks, and they pulled out a Woody doll, and they pulled the string, and it was like, "There's a snake in my boots." And they said, "Is this you, Tom?" And he said, "No, it is not. That is my brother. His brother has made a lucrative career impersonating Tom Hanks for Toy Story merchandise.
Unbelievable.
Wow. Did you know that?"
No. I did not.
Yeah, that is his brother voicing Woody in all Toy Story merchandise. That blew my mind. So
that's false advertising. That is you got to be careful about that. But I agree with what you're saying, though. I think what happened was, and kind of like Andrew was pointing out, they tried to capture the Robin Williams magic. There's certain actors, depending on how they relate to the character, the effort they put in. I sometimes think some of these stunt casting are just, it's a paycheck.
Yeah.
They come in, they say the lines, I can clearly hear it's you. There's no, it's, you know, you were talking on the voicemail. It could be like one of those cameo things they pay for and they wish you happy birthday.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I'm not a fan of it. I prefer
quality.
Not, like you mentioned the actresses that voice Belle and Ariel. I prefer not picturing their faces when I watch those movies. But when you stunt cast, that's all I see are those celebrities that are voicing these things. So if I was, in charge, I would say, no, we're sticking strictly to voice over actors, and they deserve that paycheck.
Has Taylor Swift done any animation yet? I'm not sure yet.
Not yet. Give it about 8 months.
The only thing that comes to mind is she was in the Cats musical.
We won't.
That's for another podcast.
I thought we were keeping this civilized, but apparently not. Jeez.
One more thing I wanted to mention as far as Disney's release schedule this year. This isn't necessarily a Pixar release, but Disney is releasing a sequel, which is actually a prequel, to the live-action remake, which I want to say in quotes, live-action remake of The Lion King. So this isn't necessarily a prequel to the animated. It's the live-action prequel. And this is kind of confusing. So
yeah, I'm lost.
It tells the origin story of Mufasa from the perspective of the grandchildren of Rafiki and Kiara after Simba ascends to as the new leader of the Pride Lands. So
what is that pitch meeting?
Yeah.
Who sits in that? Now, hear me out. Whatever Joe just said. What?
Yeah, so it's basically going to be set with these characters. So in a way, it's a sequel, but they're going to tell the story of how Mufasa came into power. So it's going to be a look back. So it's kind of a prequel and a sequel at the same time, I guess. Hmm. And I'm confident, I will say right now, my butt will not be in the seat for that. Let's talk about that since we're into this. Disney has been doing these live action remakes.
Thank you.
And the term live action, I want to file a lawsuit. I want to file a lawsuit against Disney and say, define live action.
Yes, thank you.
The Lion King remake, as far as I know, is 100% computer animation. There were no live lions used in the making of this
film. I had a friend ask me that. Like, why is it not live action? Have you heard a lion talk? What lion moves its mouth like that? Go to the zoo. Stick your face in that clothes. It'll eat you.
It's a computer animated movie. And when you look at live action remakes of Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast, those, other than a couple of human figures in there, for the most part, those movies are like 90% computer animated. So I hate the fact that they're saying, oh, we're doing a live action remake of this. It's still a computer animated movie. If you're going to do a live action remake of Finding Nemo, you're not going to put real fish in there. There's going to be computer animated fish. You can't call it live action.
It's a live action remake of a video game Rampage. That's, of course, a 75-foot white fur gorilla. I mean, come on.
That's a big pet peeve of mine. That's like, you know, saying I can't believe it's not butter. Well, it's not butter.
It's a shameless cash grab.
I have no interest in seeing it. Have you guys seen the live action version of The Lion King? I'm curious.
I didn't see any of them.
Is it a musical? Did they still sing
songs?
They'll
force songs in them. I'm sure they will. They did it for Aladdin. They try to recreate songs. Yeah. Look, if you do you. Enjoy yourself. If you have a great time, go do it. That's like people that enjoyed, you know, Star Wars Episode 9. They were clapping and thought it was the greatest ever. Like, hey, you do you. My bus stop was Return of the Jedi. I tipped my hat to you. You guys have fun. But it's the same thing. Disney's not mine. My Disney is for me, and I'm perfectly okay with it. If that makes me sound like a boomer or you know, past my generation, I'm fine. You guys get to enjoy it. I had a great time in the 90s, 80s and 90s and early 2000s. Yeah. That was my jam. I got to enjoy it. I love. If you guys have fun with it, have fun with it. We're making a live action of it. Go ahead.
Yeah.
It's not an original story. Some of these were adaptations of stories, too.
Yeah.
I can't say like, hey, you know, Beauty and the Beast was an original Disney thing. Actually, it's based off a fairy tale. Oh,
it
right.
is. Go ahead.
I was going to say the one live action remake that I did like, also directed by Jon Favreau, was The Jungle Book. I really did like that.
They did a live action remake of that? I have no memory of that.
Yeah, 2016.
Yep.
Wow.
I saw it in the theater, and I thought it was really well made. Hmm. The little kid who played Mowgli was great.
Huh.
Did you see it?
No. When they said it's a live action, I'm like, I've seen the animated one.
Well.
Good. I read the book.
And as far as I know, it got, like, pretty good reviews.
No memory of it at all.
I really liked it. And I would recommend seeing it compared to from what I've heard, all the other live action remakes. Which I have not seen because they looked awful. This one, I really enjoyed.
Then I will do it. In an act of solidarity for all the crap I've given Andrew on the show, the movies he's not seen, I can do, I can extend this.
When was the last time he brought up a movie he saw that neither one of us has seen?
Oh, it happened. I can't say when. Yeah,
down. Mark it down.
Yeah, it's very rare. And it's usually one of those artsy flicks where, you know, it's only shown in one theater in a gully somewhere. That Andrew's like, I was finding it when I was out there hanging out with some buddies, you know, drinking like, you know, craft beer or something. And it's
remember
like,
this day.
No, drink it. No, and do an acid.
Yeah.
No,
I'm joking.
Now, I did see Beauty and the Beast, the live-action remake. I adore Emma Watson, and I thought she was perfectly fine in that film.
I heard it was pretty decent.
The one gripe that I have, and this may segue into something else, but the one gripe I had with that movie is they were like, oh, we're going to add like some new songs to this, and I'm like, okay. And so when they sang the songs that were from the original animated version, those were great, and then here comes the new song. And I think the Beast was singing, and I'm like, this is awful. This new song is terrible. Why did you feel compelled to add this new song? And here's a gripe that I have. I went to the theater to see the Mary Poppins sequel, I guess you would call it, reboot or something. Now, when you watch the original Mary Poppins, it's a delight. And those songs are just so catchy that you find yourself singing them immediately after watching the movie. But when I saw this reboot with Emily Blunt, there was nothing necessarily wrong with it. I thought she was fine in it. But every song was instantly forgettable. Like, nothing was in my brain.
It's a tough act to follow.
Yeah.
Dick Van Dyke and
Julie Andrews.
Legend. I mean, that's... That wasn't a memory pause. I literally, it's Julie Andrews. for those on TV, on videos. Yeah. But, you know, trying to follow Dick Van Dyke and Julie Andrews, it's an impossible task.
But not necessarily just those performances, but those songs. Yeah. So there's something about those early Disney songs, whether it's Snow White or, you know, whatever. Those songs were just infectious, man. You found yourself singing those, and they became just embraced and beloved by the American public. And now when a new Disney movie comes out, you're like, eh.
I'm going to play devil's advocate on this. Andrew, so you think it's more because no one's had a chance, like our childhood's already gone. So we've had our songs from our childhood and growing up.
It is?
Don't you do that, because if you start, I'll start. But these songs might be forgettable for us, but are they memorable for these kids who will become us one day and think back to these songs?
Sure.
And because when Mary Poppins came out back then, there's no competition for it.
Yeah.
You will get Mary Poppins on Saturdays. It's Mary Poppins and nobody else. Now they got competition of the yin yang.
Yeah. And so that brings this up. So you say, will a future generation who grew up with these movies be singing these songs 10, 20 years from now? No. Because they have Taylor Swift. They have other things that they've claimed as their own. Movies do not mean the same thing to the young people of today that they did when I was young.
Excellent point.
And I'm starting to sound like Yoda. Look, I so old to young eyes.
Don't ask that question. They always say yes. They always say yes. I made that mistake.
But to answer your question, no, these movies do not mean the same thing to this generation.
Well, I think Andrew might have mentioned this in a few shows ago. Taylor Swift's concert would sell out at a movie theater faster than an actual movie.
Yeah, easily.
And Beyonce's tour would sell out on a movie theater, and AMC and other theater chains would rather show that than dedicated theater. And so, yeah, you're right. There's competition. Look what they're competing against.
Now, since we're talking about Taylor Swift, I will justify bringing this up because her concert movie is airing on Disney Plus, I believe. So I watched it this past weekend, and I was texting my niece, who's a huge fan, and my sisters, giving them my feedback. And I will say this, even though I wasn't familiar with probably 75% of the songs that she performed, I did think the production values were amazing, and she's very, very talented. But I will say this, when she started performing a song that I was familiar with, a big smile broke out across my face, and I felt like one of those kids that you see on TikTok that stand in front of the TV 6 inches away and start singing the song. Her songs are pretty catchy if you're familiar with them. So, yeah, Taylor Swift is what these kids will remember 20 years from now.
Andrew, Joe's just solved Disney's problem. Hire Taylor Swift to write the songs.
Can you imagine a Taylor Swift penned Disney musical?
Oh,
Alan Menken and Taylor Swift are conducting the story, the soundtrack for
Gold.
By the way, you owe Hollywood Blockbusters for that idea.
Yeah, well, Disney, you consult with us. We put it out there, but yeah. Oh my gosh, that would.
I was just looking this up, and the last memorable Disney song I can remember was 11 years ago with Frozen, "Let It Be,"
or "Let It Go."
I'm sorry. Yeah,
you're thinking
not the Beatles. Yeah, "Let It Go," which came out 11 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, can anyone think of a popular Disney song in the popular lexicon since then? I can't.
Right.
But
now someone out there might be saying, oh, a song from Moana or something. No, I agree with you. That might be the last earworm that Disney released that everybody was singing. Yeah. And that's that goes back to that classic Broadway sound. That song was epic. It was big and it was catchy.
And in the 90s, you know, you had A Whole New World with Aladdin. Yep. Little Mermaid songs,
Beauty and the Beast,
Tales of the Lion King song. But since then, last 11 years,
you got a friend in me.
And why is that? Why is Disney not churning out the beloved classics that they did from the beginning? Like, I mean, you know, I just recently rewatched Snow White, and you know, someday my prince will come, and hi ho, hi ho. Those are. From the get-go, those songs were catchy and memorable, and that continued for what?
It comes down
40, to 50 years.
I think it comes down to the story, and that's where I think Pixar was really great. When Toy Story came out, Lasseter had this effect of putting emotion and life into inanimate objects.
Yeah.
Toy Story was fantastic. You know, you got a friend in me. It's great. When you sit down in 1995 and you watch that, like, this is great. And you felt for all those characters. And it's one of those things that gets you thinking. When I was a kid, I had toys. I had Transformers, G.I. Joe. They all meant something to me. They got me through tough times. I enjoyed playing with them. And then I get older and I just throw them in this little bin as if they're nothing. You know, my mom sometimes gives them away, which and I cry about because they're worth so much because they're Transformers. And I can't believe they're I don't want to get into it.
This just happened last week.
Yeah. You did
I don't want to talk about it.
You gave them away. I didn't know they would be worth something. Duh. It's like I threw away a card by some Baby Ruth. Baby Ruth? Dead.
Now, since you brought this up, I'm going to use this opportunity to transition, to segue to our favorite Pixar movies. And if you want to throw out your favorite Disney movies too, I almost said Disney. If you want to include your favorite Disney movies, you can. But I concocted a top 10 list of my favorite Pixar movies. And the funny thing is that this isn't going to take a whole lot of time because the top three movies on my list are all Toy Story movies. One, two, and three, in my opinion, should be considered one of the greatest trilogies in the history of films. You got your Star Wars trilogy. You got your Indiana Jones trilogy. You got your Rocky trilogy. Toy Story ranks right up there. The original Toy Story that came out in 1995 that introduced us to all these characters. It was the very first fully computer animated film ever, which was a milestone along the lines of Jurassic Park and all these other movies that changed cinema.
Yeah.
Toy Story changed cinema.
$30 million budget.
Yeah, yeah. And it was so funny and so charming with jokes for adults as well as kids. And that's what's so great about a lot of these movies is they're not kid movies. Parents who take their kids to the theater to watch these movies are just as entertained as the little ones, maybe more so. So Toy Story kicked it all off in 95. 4 years later, we got Toy Story 2 with the introduction of the toy collector character.
That's my favorite. That's my favorite.
Voiced by Wayne Knight, who was just brilliant in that. And that was just outstanding. And then Toy Story 3, which came out 11 years later, 2010, had me sobbing.
Yeah.
Like my mom just sold my Star Wars action figures at a garage sale. I was sobbing at the thought of these toys changing ownership and being handed down to the next generation. Those three movies, I wish I had children that I can sit down and introduce them and watch their reaction to these movies for the first time. They're as good as anything I've seen. Where do the Toy Story movies rank on your Disney / Pixar list?
I always use my favorite Mount Rushmore thing, which, by the way, I will visit one day. I've never actually visited, got a chance to visit Mount Rushmore, but I will. No, Toy Story 2 is the best Pixar movie for me because of the themes it had. There's this really entertaining thing with Kelsey Grammer. Gave a great performance in there too as the villain,
yeah,
as the prospector. And it says kids, and I think it was Tim Allen's Buzz Lightyear tells, he's like, toys are meant to be played with kids. Oh, mm-hmm. What's the point? You're not meant to be stared at in plastic and stood behind a wall. It's not a purpose in a toy's life.
I wish I had the audio drop. Do you guys remember there was a Saturday Night Live skit? And they were doing one of the new Star Wars movies were coming out, and they were rolling out the new action figures. And you see these kids go, you know, get the new Kylo Ren and blah, 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 blah. And you could play with them and have fights. And then these grown men pop in and go, or you can leave them in the box. And that was hysterical. And it spoke directly to me. Do you just keep them in the package and put them on a shelf? Or do you let the little ones rip them open and play with them? There's something about playing with the toys. And believe me, my Star Wars figures, which I still have today, I played with them when I was a kid, but I took very good care of them.
Right.
So today I have all the weapons and all that stuff. But, yeah, these movies spoke to me and about that argument.
But I loved it. I loved when John Lasseter said, the story's told from perspective of a toy.
Yeah.
Like a toy spends, you know, if people always say, oh, I treat my car like my baby. They actually name their car. I'm like, so if you can have the kind of transference to a car,
yeah,
you put that kind of emotion into a car, why not a toy?
Yeah.
You know,
years ago, probably about 20 years ago or so, I came into some financial difficulty, and I had a large collection of like 12-inch figures from movies and television and stuff like that. And when I made the decision that I had to sell them so that I can pay bills, that was tough. Every time I'd sell one on eBay and I sat there and pulled out the bubble wrap and put it in a cardboard box and sealed it up, I had to like compose myself. I hated boxing those up and selling them off. That was tough. So I don't know if everyone can relate to that, but I loved my toys growing up. I still love toys today. I'm still a collector today. Now, some people might say, oh, you're an idiot for collecting toys. Now I'm going to go buy some sports cards. Well, it's the same thing. Your little square of cardboard isn't much different than my Luke Skywalker action figure.
Right,
it's basically the same thing.
I have a friend who collects sports memorabilia, and I think one of the joys he said that in giving them up, he gave them to, he tried, I think he donated them to a museum. And so he'd go by there, and he'd see people enjoying it. So that was kind of like, okay, I gave it away, but at least others get to see it. So all the memories I have of when I acquired it when it was my dad, my uncle, my grandfather, going to the ballpark and blah, blah, blah. He said, I would see some kids, and if they ever asked questions, I'd go and tell them, and I'd share them stories about the thing and all that and see them get fascinated. So that was kind of the trade-off. And
yeah.
He made peace with it.
It was like paying it forward.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So maybe in that case, you know, they can't play with it. If you can actually see some of the toys you give to another child and they play with it, and you say, okay, this is now yours. You take good care of him.
Yeah.
Like I did. He got me through some tough times. So you play with him, and he'll get you through too. And you kind of make your – and that's where Toy Story captured that perfectly.
Yeah, yeah, passing them down to the next generation.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Speaking of sports cards, I just saw something recently on TikTok. Someone was doing like a top 10 list of Michael Jordan cards. Now, back in the early 90s, my brother got me into collecting sports cards, and I had a pretty impressive basketball card collection. But at the time, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this era – cards were overproduced.
Yes.
And a lot of cards from the 90s, really for the next decade or more, didn't really appreciate in value. As a matter of fact, a lot of them went down. And I had every Michael Jordan card except for his rookie card, but I had his rookie sticker and a bunch of other early cards that at the time...
To burn them.
They just never... I thought it was going to be an investment, and then I'm like, well, these aren't really appreciating. So I sold off a few, and then there was this woman that I worked with. I found out her son collected sports cards, and so I walked into the office one day with a big box, and I said, give these to your son. He'll appreciate them more than me. Well, I stumbled across this TikTok video the other day. They're like, here are the top 10 Michael Jordan cards. 9 of the 10 cards that they listed I owned.
Oh, no.
And the only one that I never was able to afford, even in the early days, was his rookie card. His rookie card was always expensive. But the grand total of the 9 cards outside of his rookie card that I owned probably are worth around $50,000
today.
Oh. And I'm like, oh, no.
Joe, you can sell your Mustang and get a brand new one,
yeah.
Man.
I'll tell you right now, everyone in the studio, Joe just had an in-studio proctology exam.
So, and I, believe me, I don't have any regrets. I never would have sat on those cards for 40 years or whatever. But when I saw those numbers, and of course these are graded, I would have had to send them out to get graded. But
sure,
yeah, it's weird to think that for the longest time those cards were worthless, and now all of a sudden the sports card industry is blowing up.
My brother had the old Star Wars stuff, and you know, and when we moved to India at one point, my mom and dad made them sell them, and he's like, oh, if I only had kept them. And I wanted to.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you think about stuff like that. I would keep the Michael Jordan rookie card, and I would keep the Washington Wizards card because I wanted to see him in another uniform. I'd burn the rest.
Yeah. Now, are you guys familiar with the blue Snaggletooth figure?
From Star Wars?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've heard of it. I've never seen a picture of it.
Yeah. So the story goes that when the Star Wars figures were coming out in the late 70s, early 80s, Sears was able to offer this exclusive Cantina playset. And one of the figures that was included in this Sears playset was a tall Snaggletooth figure that had a blue outfit. And Kenner realized, oh, we messed that up. They found out that Snaggletooth was a short little thing in a red outfit. So when they re-released this figure to the mass market, they made the little short red one. And I never really thought much about the tall blue one. And had I really wanted it back then, I probably could have got it for a decent price. Well, today, that figure sells for $400, $500, $600. If you send it out to get graded, and if it's in good condition, $1,000, $2,000. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me.
You mean if you take it in to get graded? I would never send it out because it's not coming back.
Well, that's people send in Michael Jordan rookie cards, and they
that's
come
amazing.
Back.
Well, that's a very good service, then. That's a reputable service.
Yeah, but yeah, so a lot of stuff from my youth, you play with them or whatever, and you don't really think about the value. And then for the longest time, there wasn't a lot of interest in Star Wars figures, and now, like the sports card industry, things are blowing up. So check your attics, check your basements, look for that Woody doll or that Buzz Lightyear doll.
And who knows what adventures they're having when you're not looking. That's another thing I always, what I love about Lasseter, he would ask those questions that you all wondered about. What do my toys do when I'm not there?
That's right.
What kind of adventures and trouble do they get into?
I have several completely filled baseball hardcover books, with the sleeves that you put the cards in. I collected when I was probably 8, 9, 10 in my parents' basement. I might need to go over them.
Oh, it'd be fun to pull it out and go through them. Yeah.
Yeah. Get those hermetically sealed because there could be something really valuable in them.
I don't want to speak about this too much, but eventually when my father passes on to the great unknown, he has at minimum 4,000 vinyl records.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
And he's told me, yeah, Andrew, I got a Beatles the original Beatles import from the UK that they never released in the United States, and all this stuff. And it's like, Dad, are you sure you don't want to put this on eBay? We can make $200 on this.
If you look at the vinyl, you can see the fingerprint when I snatched it from John's hand.
He will not get rid of a single vinyl.
Wow.
That's how emotionally.
Fine line between collector and hoarder.
Yes.
For the most part, except for the stuff I grew up with, I can part with just about anything except for the stuff from my youth. I told my sisters, bury that stuff with me in my coffin.
And then we got to know exactly where you're buried so Nick and I can get a couple shovels out. And
Nick, keep an eye out.
Yeah, great. We're going to be haunted by juveniles.
What are you doing? Now, along the lines, and I know we're a little off topic here, but along the lines of what you just said about the vinyl album, I have a friend. I won't name names because I don't want anyone coming after him, but he told me this amazing story about how his dad revealed to him that he had a collection of vintage comic books that were just sitting in a long box in the attic someplace. And so my friend bought a comic book price guide and said, well, let's go through them, Dad. And so they go up in the attic, they open up the box, and the dad would pull out a comic, read the title and the issue number, and then my friend would look it up in the price guide. So he's calling off titles, and then one title he calls off is Amazing Fantasy number 15. Now, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Amazing Fantasy 15, but it's the very first appearance of Spider-Man ever. Ooh. And graded can sell for $1 million or more dollars. Ungraded, I remember watching an issue of American Pickers where they came across one, and I think, oh gosh, that was maybe 60,000 or something like that, like not graded. But imagine going through comics in an attic and finding out that you have, you know, there's like some holy grails of comics. There's Amazing Fantasy for Spider-Man. There's Detective Comics for Batman. And there's Action Comics for Superman. Yep. If you find any one of those in a box in your attic, you're good. You can retire.
You know, Mark, who we've had on the show before, has spoken about the comic book bubble that was in the 90s where people like sports cards were just printing them.
Yeah,
and make, you know, oh, yes, this is like a chrome cover. Like, why is this a chrome cover? This makes no sense.
Yeah, they were creating artificial demand.
Right, yes. But now, and after the bubble burst, now if you happen to have a couple of those after they've been used as, you know, hamster cage lining and all that kind of stuff, now they're worth something because the market's kind of self-corrected. Now some of those are actually worth something.
I remember everyone got excited when they published The Death of Superman.
And
everybody ran out and bought that comic and put it away.
My grandma bought me that original comic. I don't know where it is, but I know I never got rid of it.
Well, the problem is, you know, things increase in value when there's supply versus demand. And that particular issue, everyone bought, everyone put away. And if everyone has one in a Mylar bag, there's not going to be a huge demand.
It might be worth $30.
Right. Unless they haven't anymore. Then all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute. Oh, my God. I just want to. Mom's like, I got rid of that.
I need to find that and at least look it up just to see. I'm curious, you know, what it might be worth. But, I would never get rid of that because who knows, 20 years from now, things don't change. Who knows?
You can't predict.
I didn't read comics as much back then, but I remember Tom Brokaw saying, today, Superman died. I went, wait, what? He was real this whole time? He made the NBC Nightly's news?
Let's just say, Superman's dead. I miss Tom Brokaw.
Yeah.
All right, back to our Pixar top 10 list. Toy Story occupies the top three spaces. 4 and 5 on my list can be interchangeable. Either one of them could be 4. The Incredibles, 2004. Cars, 2006. I know you said you're not a fan of Cars, but I really loved the nostalgic feel of Cars and hearkening back to the days of Route 66 and getting bypassed because of the freeway and all that stuff. And I'm a car guy, so I love those two movies. But Incredibles, what's great about Incredibles is that it's not based on any existing property. It's just an original Pixar/Disney creation that just absolutely blew me away. Now, I mean, I guess you can loosely compare them to the Fantastic Four or something like that, but The Incredibles was great. I mean, definitely one of the best Pixar films. After Cars, I got Finding Nemo, 2003, and then 13 years later, Finding Dory. I thought Alan did a great job in Finding Dory. The character's absolutely lovable, and so that's 6 and 7 on my list. Probably close to a record between a movie and its sequel. 14 years, Incredibles 2 came out in 2018, and that blew me away. I thought that was absolutely outstanding.
That raccoon scene.
Oh, my God.
With the baby.
That was awesome, yeah. And then to round out my top 10, Bug's Life, 1998. Yep. I really love that. David Foley, who I loved in Kids of the Hall. He did that one voiceover gig. And then top number 10 on my list is Monsters, Inc., 2001. I just recently watched Monsters University, which I enjoyed, but now that's my top 10. What would be in your top 10 that might surprise us?
All three Toy Stories would make it. Bug's Life would make it. Wall-E would make it. Incredibles would make it.
Let's talk about Wall-E for a second. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that. I saw Wall-E in the theater, and I remember not liking it. And here's the reason. It was, out of all of Pixar's movies, it was the most cynical.
Yeah.
Like, it had a very cynical look at the human race and where we were headed. But now I apologize, because it was spot on. They nailed it. People, overweight blobs with devices up against their face that they just couldn't look away from. I'm like, holy cow, this is almost like Nostradamus quality. So I take back any negative thing I ever said about
Wall-E.
But
no, I remember the time watching, like, you see Earth ruined, yeah, and everyone's gone.
Disposable.
Like, yeah, and the humans are just, like, plugging on these little floating chairs. When they get tipped over, it's like a sea cow fell over. Like, oh, my God. Really? Yeah. This is what you think of? I was like, oh, I get it.
Wall-E has aged very, very well and now has become satire, I guess. I don't know what you would call it, but, man, they were spot on. So what I thought was being overly cynical when it came out, now I admit they knew better than I.
And the thing is, for me, for Pixar, it's – I wasn't a kid, but I was a teenager, and I was just becoming, you know, getting over 18, going into becoming a young man. So – I was at that perfect range where I got the adult humor and I got the kid humor. I got to enjoy it all.
Yeah.
And that was basically hitting back-to-back-to-back-to-back home runs. I got Toy Story, Bug's Life, Toy Story 2.
That was a great period.
You know, they would just keep going. And I had Wall-E. I had The Incredibles. I was like, they can't miss.
Yeah.
There was like a string. I was like, hey, you know, we're just going to Cooperstown on this. When does this machine stop?
Yeah, it's like a home run derby.
And that's why, you know, when they were that popular – I don't know if I have a top 10, because I always go with top 4, because then I feel like I'm cheating, because I have to make tough choices. Then it's Toy Story 2, Wall-E, The Incredibles, and I would go with Monsters, Inc.
Okay.
That's my top 4.
Andrew, what do you got, Andrew?
Okay, so I've only seen one-third of the 27 movies. I've only seen 9.
That's fair. Which 9 are we talking about? This is very critical to saving you right now.
So I can for sure go by my top 3 at first.
Sure.
So I'd have to go with Cars.
That's fair.
Number 1?
I absolutely love that movie.
I have no problem with that at all.
And awesome. I watched it 2 nights ago for the first time in probably 10 years. I think it's really cool how all of the people who are supposed to be, or all the characters who are supposed to be human, are vehicles, which I think is hilarious. Even the little guys who are forklifts,
yeah.
You know, they're supposed to be
that's
helpers.
Pixar DNA, inanimate objects.
I love it. I love the fact, and you briefly mentioned this, Joe, of how a small town saw its decline after
the freeway went through,
and I don't remember what. If it was supposed to be I-40 or I-20 going through there in, like, the Southwest. And then it showed a semi-realistic view of how these small towns are today.
Right.
Like, business is just barely functioning, and most of the people have moved out.
Any businesses that are successful on Route 66, it's solely because of nostalgia. That there are people who say, you know what? I've always wanted to do that Route 66 thing, and that's what these businesses are counting on.
Right.
Yep. And then the whole character arc of
Lightning.
Yeah, Lightning.
Yeah.
How, you know, he's hot off a win, and he's driving out to, is it Vegas or L.A. to
For the big race.
For the big race, and then he runs up against a big reality check when he you know, has to have that detour off into the city. And
yeah.
he realizes, oh, wow, I'm out of my element, and yeah. these people live a lot differently than me.
And when you think about it, some of the most successful movies in film history are the fish out of water yeah. story.
Yes, yes.
He was totally thrown into an element that was unfamiliar with him and learned from it and right. grew from it.
And then,
I love it.
And then, of course, like any good story, he had a variety of people, characters within the story who view him slightly differently. Like mm-hmm. there's some people who accept him as he is right away. And then at the other other end of the spectrum, you have the character by, voiced by Paul Newman.
Oh yeah, Doc.
Doc.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's you know, he's very, you know, by the book and very yeah. strict.
The young hotshot coming to town.
But then later on, you realize he used to be a racer.
Yeah, yeah. And becomes his mentor. And yeah.
Yep. But then Lightning brings something to the town. He helps him, you know, repave the road after right. it got, you know, messed up and everything. It's not a very long movie. I think it's only about an hour and a half, which is good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
for that type of movie. I remember seeing it in theaters when it came out in 2006. I don't remember who I saw it with, but I just remember walking out. I'm like, you know, I'm not the world's largest animation, you know, Disney animation mm-hmm. person, but that movie, for whatever reason, just really spoke to me. And it's yeah. like, I felt so positive walking out of there.
I agree.
Man, just it did a lot for me.
Yeah, and the things they did to that movie, like Lasseter and his animators, you know, they would go to a race car track, NASCAR track, and kind of study everything. And when the cars would zip by, they'd see these little, what they call black marbles. And they're like, what's that? And they're like, well, that's the rubber coming off the tires. They form these little black marbles. And Lasseter, like, turned to his animator and said, we need to put that in our film. So when next time you watch Cars, look for the little yeah. black marbles dancing on the racetrack when the cars go by. That's the attention they had to detail.
Wow. Okay.
And
yeah.
It's makes sense. They did the same with Bug's Life. They put a camera on a little stick and they rode it through the back garden. They're like, yeah. you just see the perspective. Like, oh wow, it looks like yeah. a different world.
It's impressive. Yeah.
So
who else is in your top?
So,
what else?
This is a tie. A tie for number two. Toy Story, simply because it was the first one. It started it. I don't remember who took my sister and I to the theater. That came out in what, 95?
Yep.
Yeah.
I was only 11. I was young enough to.
You were the target audience.
Yeah, I was young enough to yeah. to get the animation, and but also to see, like, to understand what was going on. You know, like, okay, there's a kid and his toys, but you know, maybe there's another life, and you know, it really brought back some imagination.
Yeah, yeah, nostalgia.
Yeah, nostalgia. And being 11 at that time, it's that middle period of like, all right, for me, like I got to get rid of my toys. Can't be playing with that anymore. Looking forward to, you know, trying to be an adult, but it's still.
You were getting it at 11?
For me, it was probably about 14 yeah, when I started.
Oh, man, I was, Andrew, they didn't even let yeah. you get to your teens before you have to start thinking about being an adult? And all yeah. that kind of stuff. Yeah, hey, all right.
I don't know. Like, I bought Empire Strikes Back figures, so I was about 13, 14 when Empire Strikes Back came out, and then there's a cutoff there where I have no figures after that. So right around when I turned 13 and 14, that's when I was like, okay, I'm done with toys. Girls are pretty.
Yeah, yeah, I respect yeah, that. Yeah. You made that decision at 14. Andrew had to make that choice at 11. I did it at 32.
Well, now I'm a born-again toy collector.
So, and then my third one, and I have a couple of others that are just under my top three, but the one that really got me emotionally was Up.
Thank you. I can't believe, yeah, Up. Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah.
That opening.
Yeah, that opening with his wife.
Yeah.
And him, you know, having that little house where they're building that extra downtown around him. Yeah. It's like, and then he meets the little boy who's so innocent.
I think Andrew just triggered me because that, I can't believe I blocked that because
Here's what I'll say about the first, I don't know how long that opening montage lasts.
Probably 15 or 20, I'm guessing.
That long? It might be less than that.
Nah, it's less than that.
Maybe less.
I will say this. The first opening segment that tells a story between the guy and his wife is not only one of the greatest Pixar movies ever, but one of the greatest movies I've ever seen.
Yeah.
After that, not so much. I didn't really care with the dodo bird and the talking dog and all that. I found all that stuff kind of silly. But again, when it comes to like sobbing during a movie,
yes.
I can't believe the emotional impact that first opening montage had on me when I saw Up.
And I was thinking about it like, if there have been a couple times where I've teared up in movies, yeah. Never once in the first 15 right. minutes of it.
Boy,
never.
They came at you with
that. That, yeah. I think that's why I almost had to block it out because I was like, am I crying? Am I sobbing?
What is this salty discharge?
I was like the Grinch. I have a heart. Oh my God, I have a heart. This is painful. What's going on here?
It was pretty spectacular.
And then I'll just go just for a minute. Some notable follow-ups. I thought Finding Nemo was decent. Ratatouille was decent.
Oh,
Ratatouille. But I really, really liked Monsters, Inc.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now, but since then, the last Pixar movie I saw was Cars 2 in 2011. So it's been
a while.
It's been 13 years since I've seen a Pixar movie. So
I didn't hate Cars 2.
It doesn't compare to the first.
The problem with Cars 2 is with the success of the first Cars, I'm sure the people at Disney and Pixar said, "Oh, the kids seem to like Mater. Let's do a whole movie around Mater as the main character." And less Mater is more. Like,
yes.
You can't revolve an entire movie around Mater. He's a sidekick, you know. So that's the issue I have with
too much of him is too much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, that's like when they tried to make a side character and they gave Lightyear his own movie. I went,
"Oh, right.
Okay, it's good. It's not great. It's good, not great."
Was it probably leave wasn't it well necessary?
Yeah. I mean, that was one of those things where I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And then they did Cars 3, which was more recent.
Yeah, I've never seen.
And that again ranks among the most depressing movies that Pixar has ever released. It basically has Lightning coming to terms with the fact that he's old and obsolete, and I'm like, I don't want a Pixar movie to tell me I'm old and obsolete. I took that personally. So it wasn't a bad movie, but it was very, very depressing.
Was it kind of along the lines of how Toy Story kind of leaned into obsolete toys?
Yeah, kind of.
Well, Toy Story 4 kind of took it off the rails a little bit. That's why I don't put that up there.
I don't even like talking about Toy Story 4. It's one of the most unnecessary sequels
I've never seen it, and everyone told me stick with the first three.
Unnecessary.
Yeah, stick with the first three. Because at Toy Story 4, I mean, I don't care for spoilers, they broke up the group. That was like such a weird thing because there was just like, oh my God.
Yeah, I didn't care for that at all. You didn't have to do a fourth one to say, oh, guess what? We're splitting up the gang.
There's a theme running in Hollywood, I want to say, where they take stuff that we grew up with and they're like, what happened now? Let's try to break it apart. Like, no, I don't need to see Indiana Jones broken down. I don't need to see Luke Skywalker at the end of his, like, all right, guys, all right, if you really want to, I mean, why not just tell a whole new Star Wars story? Just take it in the universe and do something else with it.
Yeah.
Like, don't show me what happened to Lightning. Like, I don't need to see what happens to all this.
Yeah.
Like, just tell a different story. Like, are you going to show me The Incredibles when the kids are grown up and married and like have their marital problems and mom and dad are now in retirement? Like, well, I don't
divorces,
need to see.
Divorces.
Yeah. You're going to kill
suicides.
Frozen. Like, Frozen got killed by the cops. Like, what are you going to do? Like, I mean, what are we doing here? Jeez.
You know what I just brought up? I brought up the highest grossing Pixar movies of all time. What would you say ranks number one?
Good question.
Number one?
Yeah.
Let me.
Well, adjusting for inflation, I mean, I'd still go Toy Story 2.
Close. Toy Story 3 is the top grossing Pixar movie, according to this list that just popped up. Finding Nemo, number 2.
Yeah.
Up. Number 3.
Okay.
Incredibles, number 4. Finding Dory, number 5, Inside Out. And this kind of surprised me. Monsters University cracks the top 10, followed by Coco and Incredibles 2. So, yeah, those are your top grossing movies. And that tells you what kind of movie Toy Story 3 is, that it put butts in the seat. That spoke to not only young people, but adults.
But that also felt like they were kind of saying bye to that franchise. And that's like Indiana Jones riding off into the sunset. I get it. Okay, let's end it there.
Yeah.
Nope.
Don't
not going to do it.
Bring back. Yeah. It's just a money cash grab or whatever. So, is that it with your list, Andrew?
Yep.
All right. So, yeah, Pixar, you know, there was a long stretch of time where they just could do no wrong. Every movie was great and made money and spoke to the old and young alike. Lately, not so much, but we'll see.
I feel like they lost that rebel spirit because, like I said, if you guys ever get a chance to watch Pixar Story, what they did to get a Toy Story made and then Toy Story 2 made was incredible. Mm-hmm. Toy Story, basically, Jeffrey Katzenberg kept messing with it, and when they showed the stuff, they're like, this sucks. Like, why do we hate it? Like, it's not their movie. John Lasseter and the company rewrote and redid Toy Story in 2 weeks to take it back to Disney so they can keep the movie going. Mm. And they did it. Toy Story 2, John Lasseter had to take a break because he'd done Bug's Life and Toy Story and went and had a vacation. Toy Story 2 was going to go straight to DVD. They said, no, let's put it in theater. They came back. It sucked, apparently. He saw, they're like, you have 9 months to get this. They rewrote the movie redid the animation in 9 months.
Whoa.
Disney's like, we can't move the release date. It's fixed. Are you going to deliver it or not?
Yeah.
And so Peter Schneider, who was the head of animation at the time, was like, hey, don't wait for my notes. Just do whatever you got to do. Mm-hmm. Don't run it by me anymore. Just do it and pray.
Wow.
And they had that. They were like, this is like back in the old days. And they could finish each other's sentences and they would just keep moving. And some of that, you know, and then you have a hit after hit after hit.
Yeah.
And then.
Well, that really paid off.
Yeah. And then people, you know, started doing their own anime. And then Lasseter left. And then you kind of see there's something to be said where the vibe and the type of way they tell stories, maybe the formula has changed, and they haven't really figured it out yet. So
yeah. You know, we started off this podcast talking about Luca, how it got re-released this past weekend. Here's the movie in a nutshell. Luca is a shape-shifting sea monster posing as a young boy who spends his summer on the lush Italian Riviera in 1959. It just makes no sense. And like I said, as I'm watching it, that starts off with his underwater family who are like shepherds. They shepherd fish, which I don't know how they came up with that. And then Luca runs in to a fellow sea monster who ventures onto land. And the moment he steps foot on land, he transforms into a human boy. And then he teaches Luca that he can do the same thing. And as I'm sitting there watching, I'm like, who came up with this? This is nonsense. A sea monster who transforms into a boy on land. And I tapped out. I'm like,
and it kind of borrowing the theme from Little Mermaid.
But she, at least they established that she had like a wish granted to become human. There was like no explanation as to why these sea monsters had the ability to turn into humans on land. And I want Pixar just to get back to simple storytelling, either adapt beloved fairy tales that go back hundreds of years or come up with something new. But
what was it? Elementals was one of the ones that just came out. Did they do that one? Was Pixar one with water, fire?
Yeah.
Talking about a society where all four live and
yeah. Now, one Pixar movie that not a lot of people talk about that I really enjoyed, and I think there's going to be a sequel coming out in a year or so, is Zootopia. We have not discussed Zootopia.
Because here's the thing. That's in the time when it was having hit after hit after hit. Zootopia was great. The original story, I'm glad they changed. The original story had a little bit of a darker tone.
Yeah, and it still had a little bit of a darker tone because When you're sitting there watching it, you quickly realize that the movie is basically a parable about racism.
Yeah.
It's like a lecture about racism. And I'm like, wow, this is kind of deep for a Pixar movie. Yeah. And it was a little dark.
Are we sure that was Pixar? It's not on my list of Pixar.
It is.
It was Disney. Oh, you know what? I think Disney got it. But I think what happened, that's after last they bought Pixar, but you could tell it had a very Pixar influence on it.
I thought, so it's Disney, not Pixar?
Yeah, it's not on my Pixar list.
Yeah, it'll be the Pixar people. You can see the Pixar people being behind it, but it's not at that point. And that's another thing. When Disney basically begged to buy Pixar, Steve Jobs basically, if you want us back, baby, we gotta sit on the board.
I did see Zootopia, and I did like it.
Yeah, so it says here it's a 2016 American animated buddy cop action film produced by Walt Disney Animation Studios and released by Walt Disney Pictures.
Yeah.
I had assumed it was Pixar.
And you wouldn't be wrong, because it has a lot of Pixar fingerprints on it. Because remember, Disney had bought Pixar a lot before then.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there's a lot of Pixar influence in that.
Sure.
Interesting. Sure. All right. Learn something new. But if you haven't seen Zootopia, check it out.
Yeah.
It's
really
good. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Anything else you guys want to wrap up on? Anything you're looking forward to coming out from Disney or anything?
I have this desire to go binge watch a bunch of old Pixar movies now.
I know.
It's
like comfort food.
My number one, I need to watch is WALL-E.
Yeah. I'm going to have to revisit WALL-E. It's been a long time.
Online yesterday, I was looking at I don't remember who it was, but they said, from worst to best of Pixar, and it had WALL-E as number one. So
interesting.
I figured, you know what? I haven't heard anything bad about it, really, so I'd like to watch it.
And tying back to one of our episodes in our previous incarnation, Toy Story 2 is one of those things on my top 100 list. If it's on, I'll watch it.
Oh, sure.
If it's on, I'm like, I'll watch it now.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't care what point in the movie it's
at. I've only seen it once when it first came out in the theater. And that's it. So I don't really remember. So I definitely need to watch that again.
Yeah. Toy Story 2 was just great.
Yep. I will say this, since we're talking about toys. When Cars came out, Mattel started releasing diecast versions of the characters from the movies. And I collect diecast cars from television and film. So I started buying all the Cars, diecast cars. They weren't necessarily Hot Wheels, even though Mattel also makes Hot Wheels. But they did their own scale and their own line. And I found myself buying every release that came out until I had bins and bins and bins full of Cars, diecast cars. And all of a sudden, like a few years after its release, these became like gold. They got hot, hot, hot. And I couldn't sit on them any longer, and I started selling them off. And I hope the IRS isn't listening, but I made thousands of dollars on Pixar diecast cars. It was crazy.
Joe, don't underestimate the reach of Hollywood blockbusters. And two, all that you just say was, I did well. That's the code. When you preface with the IRS, just say, I did well.
I made more than what they sold for at retail. And you can still find them in stores. They're still releasing characters from the films. In stores. And I didn't sell everything. I have a little core collection at home. As a matter of fact, you'll appreciate this, Andrew. I have every racer that raced in the Speedway of the South Dynaco 400 race or whatever.
Really?
From Mood Springs to Vinyl Toupee to all the characters. There's probably about 30 or 40 race cars that took part. Including, I kind of got a bootleg Apple 84 car. There's a little cameo in the race of a white Apple car, and it has 84 on the side. But, yeah, I'll have to show that to you someday. It's a pretty impressive collection of every race car that took part in that race.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's fitting we were talking about Pixar because it fits the name of the show, Hollywood Blockbusters. For a while, that's all they were. They were Hollywood Blockbusters.
Everyone was a blockbuster.
From 95 to about easily till 2014, 2015. That's almost a 20-year reign of just knocking them out.
I will say this about Ratatouille. Again, that's another one that I only watched fairly recently, and it grossed me out. The thought of rats in a kitchen preparing meals, I'm like, who came up with this concept. It's gross.
But you know what? I'll give Ratatouille credit. If you can get my mom to watch that movie, my mom just hates rats. She hates critters. And she was like, I don't know if I can watch this. And then she would just watch it. Like, oh, that's adorable. I'm like, well, I was like, wow. Jesus, Lasseter, I guess you can even get my mom to turn around.
No, I'm sitting there like Indiana Jones. Oh, rats. Did not like that. All right, on that note, we're going to wrap up this episode of Hollywood Blockbusters, our Disney Pixar look back at their releases.
Yes.
And we will be back in a couple of weeks. We haven't decided on the topic yet, but we'll come back with something I'm sure you'll love. And once again, we'll leave you with this little ditty.
Come to the movies. Watch Charlie Chaplin. And put some sunshine into your day. Forget the hard times. Come to the movies and try to laugh your troubles away.